WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and my guest is trumpeter Red Rodney. Summertime is jazz festival time, and the Mellon Jazz Festival is underway in Philadelphia. Trumpeter Red Rodney is returning to his hometown as the festival's honoree. Rodney went on the road when he was still a teenager and played in the bands of Claude Thornhill, Gene Krupa, and Woody Herman. In 1949, he ended up in the place just about every young jazz musician wanted to be, Charlie Parker's band. Parker hired him to replace Miles Davis. But after Rodney left the band, his jazz career floundered, in part due to a drug habit. But he made a comeback in the 1970s, and he's been going strong ever since. Red Rodney is one of the musicians who was portrayed in the film Bird, Clint Eastwood's movie about Charlie Parker. Parker was played by Forrest Whitaker, Rodney by Michael Zellniger. In the movie, Rodney first meets Parker in an alley in back of a club.
Have we met?
No, sir. My name's Rodney.
You play Rodney?
Yeah, I'm with Krupa.
Do you play?
Trumpet.
Oh. And you came here to see Dizzy play?
I took the job touring with Krupa instead of staying in Philadelphia because the tour came to L.A. and I knew you were going to be here. Yeah, I came to hear you.
Now, a lot of people assume that they know you from having seen the movie Bird. How accurate a description of you was in the movie?
It was pretty accurate. Of course, some things they took licenses with. I didn't meet him in the back alley of Billy Berg's. I knew him 2 years before.
Parker, Charlie Parker.
Yeah. There was a hotel room scene which never happened. But aside from that, the wedding and the albino red bit in the south, that was true. The sort of friendliness that we had, he was sort of like an older brother. That was true. I think that came across. And I think the young man that portrayed me did very well.
Did you like the movie?
I was disappointed that they didn't show Charlie Parker like what he really did. It was a Charlie and Chan Parker. They made it a Hollywood love story, as they always do. Hollywood never gets it right. I think Clint Eastwood was given some bad advice and took it. I would have liked to seen them show Charlie Parker as the great genius of modern music, modern jazz. And that could have been another Amadeus if they had done it that way.
Now, you started off playing in big bands. How did you first hear Bob and start playing it yourself?
Well, I had already been with a lot of the name bands because the war was on and all of the good trumpet players were drafted. And I was working in the house band of Atlantic City Steel Pier when all those bands came in, minus one or two trumpets. So they needed people like me. I got a little bit of experience there. Then I went with the Elliot Lawrence Orchestra, who was at WCAU, the radio station band. And that's when I first started listening to Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and hearing this whole new thing. And I was young enough to embrace it. I hadn't had any jazz history or traditions. My whole thing was Harry James and the big bands. And I remember Dizzy took me up to New York one Sunday, sat me in the middle of the Three Deuces and to hear his band. And I heard Charlie Parker. It was like a religious experience. I was completely overwhelmed. I remember leaving that place 4 o'clock in the morning and walking around like I didn't know what to do, where to go, how to think, but I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. That's how powerful that affected me.
Well, Charlie Parker eventually hired you to replace Miles Davis. Did you feel prepared for that?
Not really. No, I told him, too. I told him I really wasn't ready for that. And he said, well, let me be the judge of that. He said, I know a good trumpet player when I hear one, and I think you are ready, and you'll be more ready once you come. And, of course, I grabbed it. I often say that was like going to college and graduate school, the 3.5 years I played with him.
Did Parker take you under his wing in addition to taking you into his band?
Well, I don't know about that. We were very friendly even before that. And, of course, we became more friendly when I was working for him. I was thrilled that a man like that could like me. I don't think I liked myself very much, but I was really thrilled that he did. And I guess you might say he took me under his wing a little bit, yeah. Of course, when he saw that I was trying to emulate him, he protested violently.
Emulate him in which ways?
Well, in his drug use. And, he got very, very upset, and of course he didn't like it at all.
Do you think one of the reasons why he hired you was that you weren't using?
I don't think he thought of that. No, I don't think so. But I know it would have been... well, it would have been more difficult if I were. I don't think he would have wanted to be involved with that. It was enough for him than to have somebody else messing around like that.
Did you start using heroin as a way to emulate him? Is that what it was about?
Yes, I was very immature, and I kept looking and looking and saying, oh, my God, if I cross that line, could I possibly play like that? Curiosity killed the cat, you know, and pretty soon... you wind up with a little habit. You don't play any better. In fact, you don't really live up to your potential because you have to be healthy to play well. And there it is. It took me years to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. What did Parker do to try to discourage you? Anything? Discourage you from using?
Well, many things. He threatened to fire me every day. he let me know... in no uncertain terms, how terrible a thing it was and how he couldn't handle it, what made me think that I could. Well, it turned out that it killed our greatest, or one of our greatest musical giants at the age of 34. And the young kid that was there, who was able to get straight, is now 63 years old and fairly successful. So there's the paradox.
Mm-hmm. Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. One of the celebrated stories in jazz lore is a story that was also recounted in the movie Bird, and that's the story of how during one of your tours through the South with Charlie Parker, he knew that an integrated band wouldn't go over well in the segregated South, that there were places you wouldn't be allowed to play. So he had the band advertised as Charlie Parker with albino red, so you were passed off as a black albino. This is a true story, right?
Yes, it is. We didn't fool anybody.
Uh-huh.
Everybody was very nice, and he had me sing a blues, and like the kid in the movie did. I think I sang better than that, though.
So. Is the story true that you ended up moving to a white hotel, and Parker said, I'll come with you, you could call me your valet?
Yeah, and they didn't show that in the movie. They should have, because that was hilarious. It would have been much better than the story they put in there in the hotel where he asked me to kick him in his rear end, and that never happened.
So tell me the valet story.
Well, after about a week or 10 days, we were in Atlanta, and I saw this big, beautiful hotel, and I said, you know, I'm going to go check in there. I'm going to take a bath. I'm sorry, but I'm doing this. He said, that's a good idea, and I can go with you as your valet. And I thought he was crazy, but he knew the South. If any white man at that time would register and say, John Jones and valet, they would not question it, and they'd give the valet a room along with him. And that's what happened. I remember him trying to send me downstairs to get cigarettes and newspaper. I said, no, you got to go down. You're the valet.
Let me play something that you recorded with Parker. Let's hear Parker's composition, Blues for Alice. And would you like to say anything about your memories of this recording session?
Well, that particular session, I was playing in the Jewish Alps, the Catskill Mountains. And all of a sudden, I got a phone call. Well, I'm in the swimming pool, and he said, you better get down here quickly. Norman Granz is doing a record date with us. And told me the studio, and I said, I'll be right down. Well, it took three, four hours to get there. But I made it, and that was it. That was the Blues for Alice Swedish Schnapps date. I think it's called Swedish Schnapps, the album. At least originally it was.
Uh-huh. So this is Charlie Parker with Red Rodney on trumpet, John Lewis at the piano, Ray Brown on bass, Kenny Clark drums. I guess Red Rodney on trumpet, and that recording of Blues for Alice, recorded with Charlie Parker and Red Rodney. Was it frustrating for you that during part of the period that you were with Parker, he was recording a lot of records with strings, which would mean that he wouldn't be recording featuring you in the small group?
Oh, it was quite frustrating. I remember I didn't know what I was going to do. I saw the handwriting on the wall that he was working more and more with strings. He tried to keep me on. It just wasn't enough money to have six or seven strings and another trumpet player. And I left and went back to Philadelphia and started working immediately. So that was okay.
What kind of work were you doing when you got back to Philadelphia?
Well, I did a lot of jazz work at first. You know, and then it wasn't so much happening at that time. So I started doing club dates, weddings, bar mitzvahs, and whatever.
That must have been very frustrating.
Very.
I mean, what kind of music would you have to play when you played bar mitzvahs?
Well, you played the standard tunes, and you played the pop tunes of the day, the Broadway show tunes. It was very good for you. Today, I go to a lot of affairs because my wife's in business, and there's a lot of affairs in that particular business. I see young jazz musicians playing in those bands, and so they make it sound much better. When I played in them, they were very corny, very society-oriented, the two-beat step, the two-step dancing with your elbows, you know, the Lester Lanninmeyer Davis type.
Mm-hmm.
But it did teach me a lot, and it gave me a big repertoire for standard tunes. So you learn whatever you do, really.
Do you get a lot of use out of Hava Nagila?
Oh, yeah, but that's only the commercial one. There's a lot of other inside ones that are very good.
Uh-huh.
And when I played concerts in Israel, they flipped out that I knew all that music over there.
Oh, really?
Sure. Because I knew the real valid Hebrew music. I knew the Hasidic music. I knew the Romanian music. And they freaked out that a jazz artist would know all of that.
Huh. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is trumpeter Red Rodney, and he's the musician of honor in this year's Mellon Jazz Festival in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is his hometown. This is Fresh Air. Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. You were telling us before that one of the reasons why you started using heroin was in the hopes that you'd play better, like Parker, who was a user, played so well, but that it didn't help your music, and as a matter of fact, it hurt your music and got you further away from it. You did this incredible scam to make money to support your habit, and I think this was in the 1950s where you impersonated a general and forged army checks.
Well, I did a lot of incredible things. I was a very good improviser. But you know something? To relate to that today mm-hmm. is like I've become a virgin with white gloves. I can't even relate to that same person. Yeah, you know, a lot of the junkies in my day went out and they stole. The musicians that were junkies stole other guys' horns and this and that. I figured that if I were going to have to do that, I would either beat the banks or beat the government. So I did, and I paid for it. And I came out a much better person. That's all long behind me. You know, and I'm not going to discuss that because it's coming out in a book very soon, and Clint Eastwood might make a movie out of it. So
oh, really?
We won't discuss that here.
Has he been talking to you about making a movie about your life?
Well, he's been talking to me about taking a first option on this book and the screenplay that we're almost finished with right now.
And the book is what, an autobiography?
Yeah.
Trumpeter Red Rodney is my guest. You spent a good part of the 1960s in showbiz, playing in Vegas bands. Why did you end up leaving jazz and going to Vegas?
Well, I had children. I was straightening my life out.
Mm-hmm.
And I, Vegas, you made a good living. You played in the hotel showroom orchestras. You worked 3 hours a day and you made $600-$800 a week, which is a very good salary, especially for then. The only unfortunate thing is there's no jazz at all. It was strictly showbiz. And eventually, my jazz roots had to catch up to me. When my kids grew and left and went out on their own, I came right back to New York and came right back into jazz. And I've been very happy ever since.
What kind of shows did you play for in Vegas?
Well, I worked in the Flamingo for many years and then the Hilton. I played Frank Sinatra. I played Tom Jones. I played so many. A lot of the big name stars. I played French Reviews at another hotel there. And all things that you really don't like doing. But the living out there is very good if you're not a gambler. Living in the desert was beautiful. It's a nice place to retire to, really. It's very inexpensive. The taxes are very low. However, there's no jazz. And there probably never will be when, you know, the people that go there for the gambling and a big extravaganza, the Hollywood-type shows. These people listen to music with their feet instead of their ears.
When you decided to go back to New York and get back into jazz, how did you start?
I went with George Wein. He called me, and it was 1974, and took me to Europe on a tribute to Charlie Parker, the musical life of Charlie Parker. I did that tour. When that tour was finished, I stayed there and lived in Copenhagen for about almost 2 years. I lived in Copenhagen, but I worked all over Europe, and that got me back into the jazz market. And living in Copenhagen was very nice, and of course there's lots of work in Europe for an American jazz musician of some standing. However, I no longer had to be away from America, and I missed it terribly. I really wanted to come back. This is my home, and I love it. So I just picked up and came home.
You had some dental problems, I think, when you were getting back into jazz.
Yes, indeed.
Now, I think that this dates back to having your two front teeth knocked out by a cop. Is that right?
Yes, in Philadelphia, 1952. That started it.
What happened? What was the story?
Oh, nothing. A guy came to examine me, so he said.
What do you mean?
Well, back then, if they caught somebody who was using drugs, they didn't have to catch him dirty. All they had to do was look at his arms and see if he had recent marks. Unconstitutional. Against all civil liberties. And that was it. Now he placed me under arrest, and I didn't say a word. And he started beating the crap out of me. You know? You know, of course, he tried to say, oh, well, he tried to fight me back. Now, how's a little guy like me going to stand up to a big 6'3" or 6'4" animal? And that's what he was.
Was he trying to arrest you for using?
Yeah. Years later, he got arrested for selling drugs, too.
No kidding,
very
really?
Very nice to know.
Huh.
Yeah. Many years later.
Was it hard for you to start playing jazz again? I mean, did you have to get back in the swing of things?
You have to get back a little bit, sure. You just can't pick up your horn and start doing it. That period in Europe was very good for me because I was working quite a bit. I was getting all my thoughts together. And when I got back to America, I was in good shape. I was better than I had ever been. In fact, my best years musically have been between the ages of 50 and 62. So I'm very lucky. Most men, in anything they do, when they reach 50, they start slipping a bit. I seem to have been shooting up and improving. I hope it continues for another 10 years or 20 years. You know.
You'll be coming to Philadelphia to perform Monday night, and you're also the musician of honor at this year's Mellon Jazz Festival in Philadelphia. Do you still have family here?
Oh, lots of family, and they're all coming. I'm very friendly with my immediate cousins on my mother's side, and of course they will be there, and my sister and nieces and nephews. But all of a sudden, many cousins from my father's side have called that I haven't seen in 40 years. So I look forward to meeting them. I wouldn't recognize them if I saw them on the street, and they're coming. A lot of friends are coming. And you know something? I'm really thrilled to be honored by your hometown, and after all these years, perhaps they've forgiven my earlier transgressions. I know I've forgiven them.
So do you do anything really mischievous anymore? I mean,
I told you, my wife calls me a virgin with white gloves.
Uh-huh.
I'm a very conservative, normal, straight-living person today. That's the way it should be. You know, after I straighten my life out, the jazz profession is very, very forgiving. As long as you can play, and as long as they see that you're okay, you're welcomed back like nothing ever happened. So I've been very lucky. And I would hope that the other people who straighten up become as lucky as I did.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Trumpeter Red Rodney. This is from his recent album, Red Snapper.